Good morning. Republicans who said Donald Trump wasn't their candidate included Hawaii's House Minority Leader. With her re-election last week, how's she reconciling her past position with a future that includes a President Trump? We'll catch up with Beth Fukumoto Chang for her take on Hawaii's GOP and her place in it. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Stacia Almahoy is a world record-holding powerlifter who's looking ahead to the 2020 Olympics. And fine arts painter Claudia Wallace offers a workshop in acrylic mixed media with a focus on composition, color, and division of space.
That's the conversation for this Thursday, November 17th, our second day of the Victory Pledge Drive, celebrating 35 years of Hawaii Public Radio. And the conversation starts after this news. Expressions of unity from the Republican Party leadership around the country have been coming in thick and fast, but is the reality of a now President-elect Trump enough to bridge the gap between those in the victor's camp and Republicans who stood in opposition to him? In Hawaii, one of the staunchest voices walking the line between support for the Republican Party down ticket, but not for Mr. Trump, was State House Representative and Minority Leader Beth Fukumoto Chang. She represents District 36, Mililani Mauka, Waipio Acres, and she was handily reelected last week. In the handful of times that we spoke during the campaign, she continued to say Mr. Trump was not her candidate. Beth Fukumoto Chang is on the phone with us this morning. Hi there.
Hey, good morning.
Good to talk to you. Now, let's start with that point that, you know, all the time that we talked during the very protracted campaign, you said that, you know, the man who wasn't your candidate, Donald Trump, well, he's now the president-elect. How is that resonating with you? What does that really mean for you?
I think for me personally, I mean, I guess for most Republicans, we'd be looking right now at trying to get jobs in the administration or other things. I don't imagine I'm high on the top of anybody's list. So that's me personally, but I think the larger issue for our party is we now more than ever are facing a deficit with women and ethnic minorities. And what we found actually is that a number of women did vote for President Trump, but still, I think especially with young women, our party's going to have a lot of recovering to do now that basically the rhetoric that he used to become president has been successful.
You are in that group that you just described. And as you say, whereas you may not be the top of anybody's list for a position beyond what's happening in Hawaii, how do you make sense of that for Hawaii?
You know, I think there are a lot of people in Hawaii. The way this, I think, most interacts with Hawaii is I've had a lot of conversations with party members locally that are excited that we have a Republican as a president and Republicans in Congress. And well, I can see from a party perspective that that's really exciting. I don't know that that helps our local party. It certainly, perhaps, maybe there's more money that comes in for local parties to give money to candidates and that kind of thing. But I think the larger issue is that we have a brand problem in Hawaii. And I can't see this current national Republican brand playing well. And that's what I've said all along, is I just don't think that President-elect Trump has the type of rhetoric or tone or even policies that are things that the people of Hawaii want.
So how well do you think that the Republican Party will be able to either reconcile or be in sync with, as you say, the rhetoric that you hear from the president and his faction of the Republican Party?
I think the Hawaii Party will be in sync, but my concerns rest with, I think the Hawaii Party will be very in sync. I think there are a lot of people that are very excited. The people that were extremely angry with me for not supporting him, who didn't see anything wrong with the rhetoric that he used with about women or about ethnic minorities, that group is alive and well in the Hawaii Republican Party. They're powerful. There's a lot of them. And they're happy to see the president's agenda or the president-elect's agenda moving forward. I don't see the Hawaii Party wanting to really adapt to a different message that would resonate more locally. But my goal is, as one of the leaders, my goal is to try to get as many people as possible to agree with me and with some of my friends that the Republican Party in Hawaii shouldn't be a party that reflects mainland values. It should be a party that reflects local values.
As we've talked about before, and as you've just reiterated, there are a lot of people who are very much in sync with what President Trump has been saying and what his brand of Republicanism looks like. But where does that leave you? I mean, you've been such a voice for being, you know, more conciliatory and bringing more people into, particularly young people, into the party and having a very different tone and a different perspective on what it means to be a Republican than what, you know, clearly we saw happen with the election of President Trump.
Right, right. I think it leaves me potentially very much alone in my own party. But I think, you know, I'm on the mainland right now. I'm actually in D.C., and I'm talking to groups that are encouraging women to run for office, encouraging more ethnic minorities to run for office as Republicans, but also nonpartisan groups that work with both Republicans and Democrats, and encourage young people. And I think that's where I can still fit. Mm-hmm. People feel like they just need to turn away from the party. They feel like the party doesn't want them, doesn't accept them. And helping them to understand that I'm a part of the party, and I feel that way all the time. But
and
the only way you can change... Oh, go ahead.
And that you're not going to turn away from the party. You're not going to
right.
become
and,
a Democrat.
And I'm not. And if you, because you can't complain about something and then not take a seat at the table when it's offered to you.
Okay, so let's talk about that table just in the interest of time, because we don't have you for very long. But now we've got a federal GOP trifecta, both houses of Congress, the president. Hawaii is a Democratic state with an all-Dem congressional delegation.
Yes.
How do you see Hawaii's issues getting attention?
I think we're going to have a lot of trouble. I think one of the mistakes that we've always made as a population is that we haven't, as a local population, is that we haven't considered what happens when we have a relatively new congressional delegation that is not in the majority party. You can still get things done. I still get things done in Hawaii as a Republican, but it would be nice if at least one of our members of Congress was a Republican and could work with Speaker Ryan on some of his issues.
Let's go back to here at home for a second. Now, we saw during this election that we're now going to be having an all-Democratic Senate, the only one in the nation. Sam Sloan, longtime GOP senator from East Honolulu, failed to win his seat. What's your assessment of that loss?
You know, I think, and what I've been trying to share with my colleagues is this goes back to we're continuing to rely on the same brand that just is not resonating with new voters. And Sam was elected for a long time. He got reelected for many, many years, but the message that he had, the message that besides not possibly not running a great campaign, but the greater message was, I can say no all the time. My job is to be in the legislature so I can uphold Republican values and vote no on all Democrat ideas. And I don't know that many people in Hawaii want to elect somebody just to go in and vote no for their party. I think most people are electing people to make progress for their district. So I think we can do that as Republicans or Democrats, but I think that style is something that we're going to see continue to be less and less interesting for voters.
Beth Fukumoto-Chang, it's been a pleasure to talk to you again. Safe journey home, and we'll catch up when you get here. Thanks very much
for the time this morning.
Thank
you. Talk to you soon. Bye.
State House Minority Leader Beth Fukumoto-Chang is the youngest person to serve in that position. The political blog The Daily Beast listed her as one of nine women remaking the right in 2013. We reached her in Washington, D.C.
Support for today's programming comes from Manoa Valley Theater, presenting The Elephant Man, based on the life of John Merrick. On stage now through December 4th, manoavalleytheater.com.
And you're back with the conversation on HPR2. Stacia Almahoy is 20 years old, weighs in at about 100 pounds, and can heft more than twice her weight with ease. She's a record-holding power lifter with Olympic dreams, dreams that call for a life of total dedication. She's with us in our studio to tell us what drives her and how she keeps up her disciplined routine. Good morning, Stacia Al.
Good morning.
How often do you train?
I train 5 times a week. It's usually 2 to 4 hours a day. We have 2 off days in between the work days.
And what do you start with? You don't just start powerlifting, I hope, right? You sort of work up to it?
We start with, well, we do box squats, so it's not a full squat. You squat to a box and then get up.
Uh-huh.
That's what we start with, and then we go into deadlifts, and then we do some conditioning work, our CrossFit side, and then we go into some accessory work.
What's a deadlift? Excuse my ignorance.
Deadlift, the bar starts on the ground, and uh-huh. you just pick it up so you're standing up.
No pause in between.
No pause anywhere, you just from the ground straight up.
And the pause in between, what's that called?
Bench press.
Okay.
So you start fully locked out, go down to your chest, you have a pause there, and then you get the bar off the chest.
In a deadlift, what muscles are most, you know, what muscles that put most strain on?
It's mostly your back and posterior chain, your glutes and hammies.
So you've got to keep those really well-tuned. You do a lot of stretching before you do any of this?
I don't. I should, but I don't.
Yes, you should. Well, what got you on this path that you're on?
I started powerlifting from my coach. So I started CrossFit at KSAC, CrossFit Strength and Conditioning. I switched over to CrossFit 50, and I started training with him actually for softball training.
Mm-hmm.
And
to what? Just to be stronger?
To be better at softball because
throw the
I'm
ball
small.
Harder.
So uh-huh. I have to be strong in order to keep up with the bigger girls.
What's your height?
I'm 4'10".
Uh-huh.
So I started training for softball, and then once high school was over, I just continued the powerlifting and then started doing that competitively and entering meets and whatnot.
The thing that most people might think about powerlifting is that it would make you bulk up and not be as able to, you know, maybe have as much finesse for things like softball.
Right.
That didn't happen to you?
No.
Why not?
Well, because I think what you're built is what you're always going to be, and you build a little more muscle, but you don't get super bulky just by lifting weights.
A lot of people in your sport do get super bulky.
They do.
Because they go in for supplements.
Yes. That's a road I chose not to do just because I feel, my coach and I feel that you can get strong if you have a good training program. And you can get strong naturally and you can go far without using any supplements to help you.
Meaning PEDs, performance-enhancing
yes.
drugs. And yet the people who do use those do it to improve their performance. They do it with the idea that they're going to get much better, right?
Yes.
Do they?
They do. They do. It also, they do get a lot stronger, and it also comes with some side effects, though, so I don't want to put up with any of that.
But you've seen evidence of it in your world of competition?
Yes. Yes.
So you're basically, you're competing against people who are using PEDs.
Sometimes, yes. There's people that use PEDs in powerlifting.
What kept you away from them?
Just, I don't want to do anything. I don't like taking medicine at all. Mm-hmm. So just taking drugs is a whole nother level.
Yeah.
I don't want to get into.
It does seem to be kind of having a strong effect on your sport, though.
It does, but I stay away from that. And my coach, Jack, he doesn't agree with doing it. Not doesn't agree, but we don't feel like we need to do it.
Yeah.
Like we feel that I can get strong naturally just by putting in work every day.
Well, since you're breaking records, that would seem to be,
yeah,
that would kind of vindicate that whole approach, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you, you know, the Olympics are what? Almost four years away. So do you have a sort of a long-term, what are you going to do about that? Are you going to add some weight? You're going to weigh more when you hit the Olympics? Or?
So I'm going to go, I want to try and compete at the 105 weight class. I have 4 years to build. It's snatch and clean and jerk, which is different from powerlifting because powerlifting is squat, bench, and deadlift.
Uh-huh.
So I have 4 years to try and get up to the Olympic numbers and have a shot at the Olympics.
So it's a little bit variation on what you have been training in up to now?
Yeah.
Well, snatch and clean and lift?
Snatch and clean and jerk, yeah.
Clean and jerk?
It's different from a powerlifting competition to where that is squat, bench, and deadlift.
What's the difference? I'm not sure I understand.
So squat, you have the bar on your back, you squat down and up. Bench is where you take the bar to your chest. You're laying down, take the bar to your chest and press. Deadlift is where you take the bar from the ground and stand up. Clean and jerk, you take it, you clean the bar off the ground, take the bar off the ground, and then it comes to your shoulders, and then you press it up overhead.
Yeah.
And a snatch, it goes from the ground, you have a wider grip, and it goes from one motion from the ground overhead.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah.
So pretty much the same muscle groups involved, right? Or
somewhat, yeah.
Somewhat. So there really is some alteration of your
yeah.
style.
Yeah, so like a bench press would carry more over to clean and jerk, to jerk part of the clean.
Mm-hmm.
And then your deadlift helps with the clean and the snatch, I would say.
How do your numbers compare now to the record-setting numbers in those particular areas?
So I believe the top clean and jerk at 105 is 230 mm-hmm. or something. Right now in competition, my clean's 180. And then the biggest snatch is 203, I think. And I've done 148 in competition.
So you've got a ways to go, but
yeah.
you've got some years
to do it. But we have some
it.
Time to do it and work to put in.
And you'll only be 24 years old.
Yeah.
It's great to talk to you. Wish you all kinds of luck.
Thank you.
Thanks, Stacia Al. Stacia Al Mahoy is a 6-time International Powerlifting League world champion in the 97-pound weight class who's training for the 2020 Olympics, and you can find out more about her on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the law firm Alston, Hunt, Floyd, and Ng, serving clients and the community in Hawaii for a quarter century. More information online at ahfi.com.
Ulana, Umau, Ukaholabe, Ohavaiti.
What happens when life throws you a real lemon? Well, the Dominus family in the early 19th century Hawaii offered a lesson. While voyaging to China to purchase furniture for his newly built mansion, merchant sea captain John Dominus was lost at sea. Sadly, this forced his widow Mary to become a landlady. Instead of living in a luxurious home, she found herself renting out suites to support herself and her teenage son. One of her first boarders was American Commissioner Anthony Ten Eyck, who is credited with establishing the American legation on the property and coming up with a name for the home, underscoring its diplomatic significance. In 1848, King Kamehameha III decreed that the title be kept in all time coming. This building is still known by its centuries-old moniker, and we'd like you to name this palatial dwelling that was the center of social and political life for more than 160 years. Not sure which house we're talking about? Don't worry, we'll reveal the answer in the second half of the show. These days, uncertainty seems to be the state where many people find themselves. That includes Native Hawaiians competing for federal recognition or independence. Civil Beat Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So, you know, as if there weren't uncertainty about this before the election, there seems to be even more of it now in terms of, you know, where do Native Hawaiians go from now? Which way, which path with the Department of the Interior? That's still in play. How do you make sense of all this, or how are you hearing that people in various factions of the Native Hawaiian communities are making sense of this?
Well, certainly, I'll just start with John Wehe'e, the former Hawaii governor, the first governor of Hawaiian ancestry. And he said, you know, Hawaiians are used to the political ups and downs based on what goes on in Washington, right? I mean, Republicans rule, Democrats rule, life goes on. And he says we're going to have to wait and see what's going to happen. But as you mentioned, the Department of Interior rules, while some Hawaiians think under Trump in the Interior Department, well, that somehow that's out the door. In fact, the Interior Department tells me that, no, the rules stay in place. That was a 3-year process to grant or recognize federal recognition. But the ultimate point here is it's not up to the federal government. It's up to Hawaiians. And I think that was the main theme I heard, among others, from the Hawaiians that I spoke to as well as listened to at a forum that was held last week. We need to do this on our own. We need to find unity among Hawaiians.
That has been a difficult proposition over the years, and certainly in very recent years, as the process of talking about what does independence mean, what does federal recognition mean, should there be a count of Hawaiians? I mean, all the things that we've talked about and had several reality checks about. What did you hear from Mililani Trask?
Well, she has been a longtime supporter of independence. You remember she led the Kalahui movement some decades ago, and she said, frankly, DOI is DOA, is the way she put it, the Department of Interior, dead on arrival. She feels that really they have to look to international law, that if they go through the interior process, that does not really grant self-determination. It will not result in a return of land and other resources to Hawaiians, with the exception of Koholawe, which is uninhabitable. She says we have to continue on this path of true independence. Now, that contrasts with the folks that say, like Robin Danner, for example, and Peter Apo, that we ought to go with federal recognition, that this is the best path forward to have a nation-to-nation, or rather government-to-government relationship with the U.S. I will add, there's another option. Don't do anything at all. Don't go for true independence, ultimate independence. Don't go for self-determination. Keep the status quo, but maybe work to change the way things are, like Kalaiakina. As you know, he was elected to the OHA board.
Right.
He liked to avoid race, nation building based on race.
This is going to be very interesting to see how that plays out and how OHA begins to weigh in on some of this, too, going forward. Been very interesting to watch it so far. We'll talk to you soon, like maybe tomorrow.
You can count on it. Thanks, Beth Ann.
Thanks, Chad. Chad joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Support for today's programming comes from Hawaii Pacific University, presenting The Gift of Story Through Music, a community event, 7 p.m. this Saturday at Central Union Church, hpu.edu/fallconcert.
Cruise down Barataria Street in Honolulu, and shortly after passing Punch Bowl, look off to your right in the 300 block for a building constructed in the Greek Revival style. This was the home of widowed Mary Dominus, who rented out rooms in her Honolulu mansion as means of financial support after her merchant captain husband was lost at sea. One of her early lodgers was American Commissioner Anthony Tenake, who established the American Legation and named the place in honor of the great, the good, the illustrious Washington, and the memory of his countryman, Captain Dominus. By royal decree, King Kamehameha III commanded that the name never be changed. In its long and colorful history, the Dominus residence serves as the home for Hawaii's territorial and state governors for more than 80 years. In 2007, Washington Place was designated as a National Historic Landmark. And surprisingly, nobody got that today. But we thank our friend Ray Lovell for sending in this quiz. And if you have one for us, write to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Claudia Wallace is an artist who loves texture as much as color. You can see it in her canvases, which seem to invite the viewer to reach out and touch. She works in acrylic mixed media. Some of her work is representational, some abstract, and she teaches a monthly workshop in her techniques. She's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Claudia.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
All right. Was that an accurate description that you have a feel for texture?
Yeah. It was something I got into. I started out with oils and worked my way into acrylics, and then I started doing collage because of that very reason. I really wanted more texture on my paintings.
You know, looking at some of your work just online, I really felt a sort of a tactile presence that you could sort of feel them, that they looked, even in a two-dimensional setting like that, they looked as if they sort of rose off the canvas a little bit.
Well, I started out putting papers on, which is more of a collage type of art, and using the acrylics. And I actually finger paint. I'll go in sometimes and I'll just mush the paint with my fingers, which is a really, gives it an interesting look.
Well, it makes you less conscious, I think, of the technique used to create the image.
Yeah, it's and it feels good. I mean, I love getting my fingers into the paint, and it really—I mean, that's something you really can't do with oils. And I started out in oils, which was, you know, I went for quite a few years, and I still do oils once in a while. I just did a book cover for a local writer, Stephen Goldsberry, Maui, which will be coming out, I guess, in Amazon in a couple of weeks. But you'll be able to see, you know, what I do in oils there. But I always go back to my acrylics. It dries fast. It's a wonderful medium. You can do so many things with it.
Acrylic is what, a sort of a thicker texture?
Acrylic, well, it's a water media, so you can use a thick impasto, which is, you know, a heavier, more like oils, but you can also water it down to look more like watercolors. They aren't as transparent as watercolors, but it's a great medium to be able to do many, many things with.
So it actually, it sounds as if it offers a wider range than some other media.
Yeah, and it's fast drying. With oils, you do have a little bit of time to let it dry. I mean, they do ask you, you know, to maybe let it go for a year to actually get completely dry. It never completely dries, but at least to the point where you can put a coating over it to keep it from scratching or, you know, having any problems.
When you do your workshops and you have, I imagine you get some people who are starting almost from scratch. How do you get them started?
Well, I give them a little basics on, you know, art is, it's actually there's a lot of structure to it. And with what I've been doing mainly is abstract. I went from, you know, representational, and I started working more and more in abstract. So you give them basics, you know, the grid on the paper and where not to, you know, so that your eye can be followed through the artwork. And then I let them go. It's unbelievable how wonderful the pieces come out that they have worked on. I give them paper. I give them all the tools that they could possibly want, everything I use, and just let them go. And then when the class is over, we have a little critique. And at the end, we are open First Fridays. So on First Fridays, I give them a piece of my wall in the gallery, and they can hang their pieces and sell them if they like.
Well, you speak of a grid. So even in an abstract conception, you're seeing, or you started with the idea of a grid behind the image as a way to sort of give balance to the composition. Is that what that's about?
Yes. It's a, you know, I guess they call it the golden triangle or golden grid, where you have you can coordinate off into maybe four sections or eight sections, and then you actually work from the corners. You don't work from the center of the piece because it gets a little stagnant there. You have to give it a little, you know, a little bit of eyeball where you can go through the painting and come out the other side, I guess.
Well, you know, that makes a kind of sense, because if you start in the middle, you might find yourself running out of room as you move toward the edges, right?
Yeah, that, and it doesn't let the eye flow. You get to the middle, and then there you are. You know, you don't really, like you said, don't really have any place to go after that.
Well, certainly in what I know best, I suppose, is photography. And in photography, you would sort of avoid positioning your main subject dead in the middle, because that's viewed as a kind of a static composition. Yeah. Sounds as if a lot of the same rules apply.
Yes, absolutely. I did a lot of photography for a while. And what I found, too, which was really interesting to me and helped me get into the abstract, was I started doing macro photography, which is, you know, you can look at a subject and it's, you know, a flower or whatever. But when you go in macro, it really abstracts that. You are looking at a small piece of whatever your subject is, and it does abstract it out. So I ask my students to bring a photograph, and then we go in and we start, you know, picking out little pieces that actually are more abstract looking.
Because, I'm a fan of macro photography myself, and you go in on something like a leaf, and you get in so close that you would never know what it was. It becomes just a pattern, right?
Right, absolutely. So, you know, I liked abstract. Like I said, I did representational for such a long time, and then I decided that it just kept getting more and more abstract. I started losing detail, and then eventually I started looking at things, like you were saying, in the macro look, and then I could go in and really abstract something.
Well, Claudia, it's lovely to look at, and I appreciate your taking the time. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Claudia Wallace offers monthly acrylic mixed media workshops in her CW Art Studio at the Art Loft in Chinatown. Her next workshop is this Saturday, November 19th, and you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
That's going to do it for our abbreviated Pledge Drive show for today. But tomorrow, we are going to be broadcasting from two islands. I'll be in Hilo, and Chris, you will be holding down the fort here on Kaheka Street.
That's right.
We'll be talking with Janice Ikeda, the Director of Operations for Hope Services Hawaii, about a street view of Hilo homelessness. Also going to be meeting Dr. Frederick Nita, longtime voice of the opioid epidemic.
And we'll get a look inside Hilo's Lyman Museum.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook.
And now we're going to go over to Wayne and Molly over at the pledge table to see how we're doing.